is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week. Why don't we kick it off with a big one? DC KO number three from DC Comics.
Knockout is what that stands for.
Oh, DC stands for Detective Comics, so Detective Comics Knockout. I believe it's actually King Omega, Justin, but from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder and Joshua Williamson, art by Javi Fernandez and Zermanico. In this issue, the tournament is heating up with tag teams bringing back.
Tag team, back again.
And you would think, like, okay, Elite Eight, we're going to get four teams. That's not what happens at all. There's another swerve from the Heart of Apocalypse as they are allowed to bring back characters who have been lost in the tournament that have...
They're people, Alex. They're people. Just so you know, they're real people.
Friends. Best friends, one might say.
Well, when they get to pick a best friend, a bestie.
Yes, except for Joker, who gets to pick from anybody because he has collected the most Omega energy so far, as is revealed here, leading to... Final four at the end at a new matchup that I think pretty much everybody knew was coming. They've been presaging it since the first issue. But that all said, I should have said this before, but spoiler warning for everything we're going to talk about here. I think we've been loving DC KO so far. Does the love continue in issue three? Pete.
Hells to the yes. And first off, a badass cover. This is one of them that are up there, but there's some unbelievable other ones that are just absolutely phenomenal. But yeah, what a just kind of heightening of the fight, and also like some of the stuff that goes down in this issue, just oh shit moments. I mean, Superman stealing the Shazam powers was insane.
Stealing?
Well, not stealing.
He worked out a deal.
Yeah. It was a little shady, but man, alive. Joker being a problem. Wonder Woman and Barda teaming up. Yes, please, all day. I'm having such a fun time with this. Just awesome. This is just such a cool event. So well executed. You get a handle on it, and then they just turn it up to 11. Yes, please. More. Thank you.
But the dial only goes to 10, Pete. It only goes to 10.
Not all dials.
Right. Are you saying it's turned up to 11 out of 50?
Yeah. By the way, sorry to take it aside. Pete, can you stop tweeting that? Every day you get on there and you tweet hashtag not all dials, and I'm like, I don't know what this means.
Yeah.
Please stop. It's not
like
you're
just a washing machine. What dials are you even using?
Some go to 11.
I agree with you. This book is very good. This event is such a let's smash our toys together situation, and it is working. Like, they're smashing the toys together so hard that Shazam and Superman come together. And an interesting thing I noticed, Superman seems to have earrings because of it.
He does, yes.
Which I thought was a nice addition. I think this picture of Superman is so awesome. Mm-hmm. The Shazam, the lightning bolt bleeding out of the Superman logo is dope. I love the way just getting down to the lettering, the way that the narration is structured here throughout. Yes. The panels reflect the let's smash our toys together mythology here. The battles bleed into each other in a way that I did not expect panel by panel for a lot of them. It just, because not only are the characters fighting, the panels themselves are fighting, the lettering and everything is fighting, the colors are fighting. Like, this is like an all-fight book down to the very medium. And I think that's such a just next-level design thinking. This is such a well-thought-out thing where I imagine, I want to be in the room. I want to have been in the room when they were just throwing ideas at the whiteboard. And seeing what stuck, because I think it's just all the ideas are fighting as well, and it means we win.
I will give this the hat trick and say that I love this as well. I am having a great time, and I'll add on the thing that I think that is making this work beyond, you're absolutely right, Justin, about all the toys in the toy box and the sense of it, but it's also that Scott Snyder has a really amazing handle on all of these characters and is able to give each of the characters their own moment of their sun, their own spotlight. I was specifically thinking of, like, Supergirl gets brought up as back as the tag team for Lex Luthor, and immediately is like, you think I'd ever team with you? No, come on, let's kick his ass. And it's a fun fight moment, but it is perfectly in line with Supergirl and her character as well. But the biggest example of it is how he's treating Superman and how he's pushing Superman in this book, which is a very different riff on what you get of, like, the Last Temptation of Superman storyline, where normally it's like, let's take away all of his guardrails and kill Lois Lane, and Jimmy gets his hands chopped, you know, just like, you really push him to the edge to see if you can get a dark Superman. This is doing that, but doing it in a logical way, where Superman is thinking around, like, wait, what would Darkseid do? How would he approach this? I got to win this tournament for good. And is not realizing, or is realizing but going down the road of temptation the entire time anyway. And it's allowing Superman to be Superman, but it has that tension running throughout it at the same time. And I just think it gives it, like, some really fantastic thematic resonance alongside the character work.
I just want to check in. So what you're saying a little bit is that if you were writing Superman, you would murder Lois Lane right away off Jimmy's hands? Like, so he can't type or take pictures?
So he can't,
so he can't
hold,
like,
the camera.
You can't
hold
the
camera. That's his worst
You're
nightmare.
Dark. Bro, you are dark, man.
No, what I'm saying, we've read a million of these scenarios. Like, the first one that comes to
Lois
mind is,
Lois Lane always dies, and then Jimmy's like,
push a character,
I have no end!
They'll push a character to the edge. Marvel does this a lot. They did this with Colossus, where they're like, we're going to ruin your life and take everybody
out of
your
life. Yeah, Colossus famously
You're the
got
nicest
his hands
character.
Chipped off.
You're the nicest character. Let's say if we can make you mean. They did the same thing with Speedball and Tournament of Independence. It happens pretty perennially.
That actually crushed me, so I get it.
Yeah,
so those are two great and equally important examples of characters. Really good.
You guys know what I mean, though.
Oh my God.
Want to throw out one thing about the art, which I generally like, but there are a couple of panels that weirdly to me looked exactly like first Raphael Albuquerque, and then there's a panel. The panel of Supergirl in particular shouting looked like Nick Dragotta. Mm. And I just wonder if, like, either way is fine, but I wonder if Javi Fernandez is aping their style, or there are some quick fill-in panels going on here and there, just because the art style seemed a little different in
How
this issue.
How dare you? This was an achievement.
I don't know. To me, it feels intentional. It feels like not the aping at all, but just like that everything is getting a little stretchy and sketchy, which is sort of like Nick Dragotta a bit at times, because there's just so much energy crackling around this fight and just this Omega, whether it's the Omega or they're in hell sort of here. So there's just, it feels like the drawings themselves are taking on this energized resonance.
Whatever
I want
to
say one more thing, though. I also, like, we didn't talk too much about all the little plot twists and turns that happen in here, which are genius. Like, there's just we've simplified it by saying it's a big fight, but it's actually, there's so many nuanced choices here that are very smartly laid out. So I wanted to give it that it's a thinking person's fight.
Yes. Mm. And speaking of which, we were thinking a lot about it. So since we have another round of the tournament down, it's probably time to check in our increasingly insane brackets that actually connect to anything. So why don't we bring those up right now?
It's hard to do brackets about a creative event, let me just say.
Yes. So here we go. I believe this first one is Pete's bracket, if I remember correctly. Yep. So we're down to the, let's talk about who you have it in the final four. So you had Superman versus Firestorm. Superman makes it. Nice. Aquaman versus Supergirl. Supergirl makes it. No, she's out, even if she's back this issue. Wonder Woman versus Swamp Thing. Wonder Woman does indeed make it. And then Damian Wayne versus Harley Quinn, and Damian Wayne made it. So you're actually like 50-50 at this point.
I think actually Pete's winning pretty handily,
probably,
if I remember correctly.
All right. I think the next one is yours, Justin. You had Captain Atom versus Jay Garrick, with Captain Atom winning. That's not nope. true.
So wrong.
Hawkman versus Supergirl. They do both come back this issue.
Yeah, they do.
That's what I was predicting. That's
yeah, 100%. Cool. Nice job.
And Supergirl comes out, but that's not accurate. Wonder Woman versus Batwoman. You got Wonder Woman. There you go. Red Hood versus Harley Quinn, leading to Red Hood. So you do have Wonder Woman. So yes, Pete is winning so far with 2 out of 4 instead of 1 out of 4. Let's see if I got any of them. Superman versus Firestorm. Superman. Okay, there we go. I got one. Right, Aquaman right. versus Black Lightning. I said Black Lightning way off there.
Yep.
Then Wonder Woman versus Swamp Thing. I had Wonder Woman. Okay, so I'm a 50-50 as well. And then I got 50-50. Batman versus Bardo with Batman winning. And Batman, I don't know. We'll see. I think he might come back to the competition.
Oh,
so we'll I'm see. Probably at 75. I think we could just kind of wrap up there.
Wow. Interesting storytelling.
That's how that works.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that's how it works. Doesn't it? No?
Nope.
All right. Well, regardless, Pete and I are tied with 50-50 to Justin 25, but anything can happen as we head towards the end of the tournament.
Truth.
Can't wait.
Next up, Avengers 34 from Marvel, written by Jen McKay and Brian Michael Bendis, art by Fareed Karami and Mark Bagley. The front story is continuing the Avengers and the Twilight Court taking on Kang, with a bit of anniversary stylings going on here because it's also legacy numbered 800. And the backstory is Bendis and Bagley taking on...
We should talk to them about this.
Hold on. Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor, and then many others meeting up on the anniversary of the Avengers. And as Pete teased, we had a really lovely, really long conversation with Brian Michael Bendis this week about this issue and many other things. That is in the podcast feed, so please do go check it out.
It wasn't too long, you know what I mean?
Nice long. That's there what I said.
It's nice long. It was great. It was a great chat.
Yeah, it was lovely. He's a lovely guy. What did you guys think about this issue? What did you think about the anniversary?
Man, this was a blast. It was a real celebration of these characters done in a kind of cool, loving way. I mean, the start of Bendis's kind of backup story was very touching and just kind of unique. It really felt like you were witnessing old friends getting together, and it was both kind of magical and beautiful. And it was kind of a felt like a fly on the wall of just old friends hanging out. So I loved it. Also, first story was a blast with Kang and all that kind of stuff. So I thought this was a really great issue celebrating the Avengers, and art was phenomenal. Tons of action, great story. So total package.
I agree in the total package, a TP.
You love a tight package.
Stamp that on the cover here.
Yeah, by the way, Justin, we have plans Halloween to go out and TP some houses, right?
Yeah, total package them. Nice. The front story is such a new, it's actually a sort of a retrospective on Jed's run, which is nice, but it's all new. It's what the story that Alex has been waiting for. The Twilight Court and the Ashen Combine are back.
Faves.
Yeah,
still
exactly.
Your heart there. Had a little moment.
A lot of words, nouns and adjectives coming together, just like we like to see. But it's looking back at all these fights. I actually really like the resolution of this fight with Kang. I thought it was really smartly done. So this was cool. The art was epic. But the other side of the seesaw is Bendis and Bagley's story, which is very much looking back. It touches on the Avengers. It uses the Avengers key cards, where they're communicators, which I thought was such a nice, like, I'm the older guy coming back here. I'm going to take something from the past that was cool, that me as a reader, I loved that part of the Avengers, like, merch, their own internal merch. So bringing that back here, I thought was awesome. The story is beautifully done. We talked about it in the interview. There's so many really nice, intimate, connective moments between characters one-to-one before we get to sort of a larger thing that happens. So, yeah, this was just a nice combination of new and old.
Yeah.
So definitely pick up.
Yeah, just to quickly talk about the Kang of it all in the first story, was such a fun idea that it was so well executed, where they were just like, oh, we're all together, now let's kick Kang's butt. It's like, actually, we're going to talk to Kang. And it was like, what? And it was such a
kind of fight.
Yeah. But we're all here together. It seems like that's the only thing we can do. But it was such a kind of cool talking it out kind of moment. That was such a kind of like, oh, crap, Kang, you know, doesn't have it all figured out. And, you know, maybe we'll learn something. So it should be interesting. But, yeah, I just wanted to kind of.
The thing that I loved about the backup story, just to agree with you guys on that, is the differences between the characters, which Bendis knows so well, even though I feel like he gets a lot of flack sometimes for writing characters very samey. They're always very jokey and quippy, but everybody sounds different. Everybody relates differently. Like you said, it is very comforting, but it's also very funny at the same time. Yeah. There's really good jokes throughout. And I hadn't realized until we talked to Bendis that Mark Bagley had retired. So
yeah, I didn't realize
really
that.
Nice seeing him on the art. And it's just some great Mark Bagley art throughout that story as well. So
yeah, just
worth it for the backup story for sure.
Nice. I also think that, like, you know, talking about what you're saying, Zelbin, of like just the looks that they were given. Like there was a one part where Tony Stark's like, well, maybe I could talk to her. And just like the other two kind of just share a look. That I was just like, artistically, that's hard to do, but it was just so well executed. And
yeah,
so
it's
cool.
The pacing of everything. Or like when they cut over to Madame Viper and she's just laughing and going like, ha 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 ha, as a punchline to a joke. It's very funny, and it's paced out perfectly. It's just two masters who know what they're doing.
And Alex, real quick, did you weigh on in the origin of the Impossible City via the Twilight Court and their turn of events?
God, I love, really love that backup story. What a great backup story. Okay, let's move on and talk about Transformers number 28 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Dan Mora. And this issue, some big boxy metal dudes are smashing up against each other, and it's roll call time. Oh, you know it is.
Yeah, roll call. Come on. Get excited.
Sandy Canyon.
Except there's one person missing. Where are they? Murder Town.
Ooh.
Also, where are the humans? At home.
No one cares. Humans suck. This is awesome. This is just...
is it?
Yes. I'm having a blast with this. I love the roll call. I love the kind of like some Decepticons kind of maybe waking up to... You know, like, hey, our leader is very unhinged and a real problem, and I don't think I'm on the right side anymore. This is just great. I'm having an absolute blast with this. And you make fun of the names of these characters, but...
No, that's G.I. Joe. We'll be talking about that.
Yeah, we'll
second.
Get into that.
Well, we could actually technically do both. Here, I'm going to read... I'm going to do a little trivia.
There we go.
I'm going to read the list. And I'm going to occasionally insert a non-Transformer nonsense word.
Okay.
Let me see if you can spot it. Just stop me if I hit a nonsense word.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Ultra Magnus.
No, that's real.
Real, yep. Just stop me if you hear one you don't think.
Okay.
Jazz.
No, that's real. I know that one.
Wheeljack.
Yep, it's real.
The Juicer.
Nah, that's fake. You can't catch me on that.
Okay.
Dude, I grew up with these motherfuckers, bro.
Beachcomber. Yeah, you went to high school with these guys, right?
Yep.
Beachcomber.
Real.
Thunderbolt.
Fake.
Wow, good call. Silverbolt.
Yeah, you're fucking around.
Silver Bowl Israel. Air Raid.
Nice.
Firefight.
Firefight. I don't think Firefight's real.
Fireflight.
You're
fire
really trying
night.
To get you like a fire starter.
I'm just saying, I'm giving you the absolute word salad that is these. And let me be honest, you look at their faces. They all look this way. These fuckers look the same, too.
Oh, come on. That's racist.
I did like the one joke of Dan Mora having, like, one of them is shorter, so he's kind of out of the panel. That was pretty cute.
Yeah, that was fun.
I will say, I know I was kind of dismissive of this at the beginning. The thing that I did like in this issue is all the stuff going on with Miles Mayhem, which you should have known what you were getting into when you hire a guy named Miles Mayhem. But him being like, I'm going to burn all these guys with acid, put on my, I assume you guys know better, mask, and then call my killer helicopter. Very fun.
Did you guys have the mask music playing in your head while you were reading that?
I don't know what that is.
Let's all sing it right now.
Yeah.
Mask formers, more than masks and I.
I want to shout out the art. The last three pages, Dan Mora's art, where the Decepticons are like smashing each other is so good.
Yeah.
Very good. A lot of this story I don't quite understand. I think it's crazy. They're like, we're voting on a leader. It's not Optimus Prime, and he's not even running. I'm like, what? He is famously the leader. And
the
they're
leader.
Like, no, no, it's this other guy who looks like him. And now it's this other person that doesn't look like either of them. And I'm like, why am I invested in the bureaucracy of who's calling the Transformers shots as much as I am here? But I don't understand how their political system works.
Yeah, I also do have questions about what's going on with the humans. Carly, and is it Sam is the male human? Where it's like they're going
to
a house.
No, the human is named Meat Bones,
Spike.
I believe.
Meat Bones. yeah, Spike and Carly, who their whole plot line seems to be like, I'm sad about my dad, and maybe we're going to kiss, but that's probably going to happen later, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
No, the juxtaposition between the Transformers who are, like, killing each other or, like, voting in a new leader, and then it cuts to their scene, and they're like, Spike, you can't give up on your dreams. Let's put our bags on the couch. It's like, okay.
Everybody's got battles, man.
The Spike and Carly pages in the past, since Robert Kirkman and 200 Get Over, are like the diametric opposite of the Skuxoid thing over in Void Rivals, where
yes.
They cut to Skuxoid and it's like, this is the most ridiculous thing that's ever happened. Spike and Carly is just like, we're just two humans doing human things.
It's like cutting to a 90s Folgers commercial in the middle of an action movie where it's like, wait, these people are just hanging out and drinking coffee in the middle of the...
Chris Farley's in there.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Plus, get free premium delivery on any bed with base. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store today.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Next up, Wonder Woman Black and Gold 2026 special. Ooh. From DC Comics, written by Tom King and Mitch Gerads, are Alyssa Wong, Steve Orlando, and Jordi Belair. Art by Mitch Gerads. I think it's Gerads. Sorry about that. Karen S. Darbo, Rossi Gifford, and Paulina Gadashow. As you can probably intuit from the title, this is a series of stories about Wonder Woman that are told all through black, white, gray. That's not in the title, but black, white, gray, and gold. I don't know. They've been doing the black and white things for a while. Now they've been doing black, white, and red. TMT does black, white, and green. So it's really shaking up the formula with a little bit of gold.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, a book like this, the artists, the stories are great. I enjoyed all of them, but man, the art shines so hard in this.
Yeah.
The Mitch Gerads art in the first story is
the use of
so
yellow
good.
And gold is just so
magical. The use of gold in this, it's so clean. It's beautifully composed. Everything is so nice. And then I really like the Steve Orlando story. The art's also excellent there, but that one was the one that felt the most different and out in its own on its own island, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. Just really impressive art takes on, you know, such familiar characters, which is great. Touching stories. Really love the kind of the second one had more of a kind of anime vibe to it, but it was still so cool. The Truth one was great. Just really kind of eye-popping, really impressive stuff. The young Diana kind of peach thief was adorable. This was just an impressive collection of stories and very art-forward, which I loved.
Yeah, great stuff. Next up, we've got Dungeons of Doom number one from Marvel, written by Benjamin Percy and Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Carlos Magno, George Gianti, Justin Mason, Robert Gill, and Carl Story. In the aftermath of One World Under Doom, Various factions are trying to take over Latveria, and in the process, they end up underneath his castle in, you're not going to believe this, the Dungeons of Doom.
What?
Where there might be treasure, there might be horrors. We're going to find out together.
Monsters?
Monsters. I thought there was a really fascinating structure to this book, which could have been an anthology, and it kind of is that, but instead it's interspersing and following these different teams as they all have their own missions and encounter these different horrors, these different terrible things in Doom's dungeons. And I just think it's a very cool way of doing it. I'm very intrigued to follow this book going forward.
Plus,
it reminded me of old war comics where you're seeing different soldiers, different groups fighting their way in a different area, and to use the dungeon as this sort of repository of horrors, I thought was just a nice conceit. Alex, you said this on the live show, but Philip Kennedy Johnson was talking about this book and how excited he was for it, and I had forgotten that until I opened it, and man, I really thought it paid off.
Yeah, and plus we got to mention the Doom Door on the cover, which is a badass cover. Sets a great tone for all.
Do you have any issue with the fact that there is no Doom Door in the book?
Well, we're seeing the Doom Door. You know what I mean? You don't have to see it again in the
book. And sorry,
you know?
Pete, this is the door to your bedroom? What you call the Doom Room, I believe?
Boom, boom, I believe.
Boom, 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 Pete's in the Doom Room.
Yeah, this is just a really cool kind of collection of stories here. You know, everyone's fighting over the Doom treasures. I was really impressed with this. And then the kind of creepy Charles Xavier voicemail message that he left to warn everybody of a creepy mutant. It's just kind of a classy move that Charles Xavier would do. You know what I mean?
Personally, was not a huge fan of One World Under Doom, and I do feel like we can kind of leave it behind. But I think this is one of the best things that came out of it, and a large part of that, at least at the beginning, maybe this is reading too much into it, but it sort of strikes me as inspired by the whole Saddam's treasure palaces thing, where they're after they had gotten Saddam out, there were various rogue factions. There was no real good plan from the U.S. government to replace him or anything or any sort of governmental structure. And then you had these various factions scrambling to take control of his weapons, take control of the various treasure in his palaces, etc. So it does feel like it has that real-world analog, particularly at the beginning there, before you get into the Cthulhu monsters and the magic and everything else, obviously.
There was a giant bat in one of those palaces.
Just one. Just one of them, though. Yeah. And he was very nice.
Yeah, Uday used to ride a giant bat around.
Yes. Anyway, my point is that, like, I think that is a interesting real world resonance they potentially have given it there, and it gives it this grounding even when it ends up in fantastical circumstances.
But just to clarify, you're wrong. All World Under Doom storyline was great, and you know, maybe if you didn't enjoy it, you're not speaking for everybody on the podcast.
I just want to. Oh, go you go. You go.
No, I was just going to say that, like, that's weird. I'm usually speaking with the voice of three, but in this case, I shall speak with the voice of one.
Good, thank you.
I just want to make sure we take note of the catch-all quote from Pete. Just to clarify, you're wrong. That's the ultimate clarification we've all been waiting for.
Yeah. And by the way, Pete, going forward, should just I speak and I'll just be speaking for all three of us and you guys can just kind of sit
here? I think it's a good idea.
Be great.
We'll just you know, I'm representing you.
Yeah, if you could just, you know, get all my bullet points so I don't have to reiterate them, that'd be perfect.
Yeah, I could do that.
Awesome.
Great.
That'd
cover.
Be great. Just you send
What's
it in
on
an
the
email.
Wall behind you? I got this.
Yeah, all right.
Pete, your review could have been an email.
Yes. Speaking on behalf of my clients, I would next like to review G.I. Joe number 17 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Tom Riley. First of all, cool cover. It's worth it for the art alone. Moving on, these characters have ridiculous names like Heatwave and Tchotchke and Preacher Man.
Tchotchke's that one.
Yeah, hold on. I'm speaking for Justin now. You've already had your time.
You had your chance on the Alex megaphone.
Yes, and now moving over to me, I'd love to talk more deeply about the art and the writing. No. But actually, I think this is really good. Like we said before, G.I. Joe has been on a roll with the Dreadnought War. This is ridiculously fun. Tom Riley's art is great. There are some fantastic twists and turns throughout here. I really like the relationship, or lack thereof, between Cobra Commander and Duke. I think they're really great opposites. And I love the end of the issue, which I had asked Joshua Williamson about back when this, before this started, and he played very cagey on, and I'm glad to know I was right about what happens on the final page.
You called Zartan?
I sure did.
Wow.
What? How? Who is Zartan?
What?
And the fact that this book, every issue ends with like, ah, I didn't know it was me. Name? Random letters that make up a name?
I'll be speaking for my client, Pete, here. Zartan is a master of disguise. He is a dreadnought. He is on par with, like, Destro, particularly, like, I'd say, like, on sort of the same level in terms of G.I. Joe villain, and he's been missing here. It's revealed that he has been in the guise of Hawk, the guy who has been running the G.I. Joe this entire time. So what does he want? What does he need going forward? Oh, it's bad news.
I also really enjoy this book. I love the idea that the Transformer that shows up here, this is the best use of the shared universe so far, where the Joes have a Transformer scout. And they're like, what the fuck? You have one of those? We want one of those. I think it's such a good, it's so good. Again, like, it feels like how I used to play with my toys, where I would mix them up and it'd be like, yo, if you get the Transformer, you're going to win this fight hands down.
Yeah,
definitely. And that's what happens here.
They have the sound effect, the transformation sound effect in the art on the bottom he's transforming. Very fun.
It is fun.
Really good. I thought the fight was great. I like all these characters. This book seems like it's having the most fun. So Zartan, no wonder he wears a disguise all the time, because he's wearing a permanent mask under his disguises.
Yeah, that's how
he's also, he's Spawn? Is that what we're saying?
It's not Spawn. He just...
Are you sure?
I don't know. I will say, before Justin pushed the picture all the way close and I could see his mouth and it was a little blurry, it looked like Spawn.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. That's Spawn.
If you look at it real quick, it can kind of look like Spawn, but
he could look like Spawn. He's a master of disguise, like Pistachio Disguise.
And please, anyone comment if you know what Alex is talking about.
Yeah,
he's the Pistachio Disguise of the G.I. Joe.
I'm going to jam an ice pick in my brain until I forget what Alex is saying.
Anyway, this is great. I guess we should move on.
It is really great, and I enjoy the nostalgia bath of it.
Yes. Aquaman number 13 from DC Comics, written by Jeremy Adams, art by Daniel Bayliss. While Aquaman is off at the DC KO tournament, Mera has stepped in instead to try to figure out what's going on under DC. What did you guys think about this one? Lots of stuff happening with ye old Mera.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you got to be careful with the order that you read this comic, because, like, you know, we got the tease of the Hawkman, Aquaman kind of versus Supergirl, Lex Luthor, that happens in the DC KO number 3. So, you know, if you, depending on the order, you could get a little upset there. Like, hey, what happened here? How come we don't get this fight?
How much money would you put down on Aquaman and Hawkman? I thought that was the most likely to lose group.
Aquaman and Hawkman?
Yeah. I mean, maybe Cyborg
up against Lex Luthor, right?
Yeah, Lex Luthor and Supergirl.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You know, if Aquaman wasn't on, like, a different planet where he can manipulate the ocean and the water and that kind of stuff. Because, you know, at the start of the fight, it's not looking good when one guy's just spacing out. It's like, hey, you ready for this fight? Oh, what? Oh, yeah. Sorry, man.
So sorry to interrupt. Just to talk about this comic that we're talking about right now.
That's what I'm talking
about. I thought Daniel Bayliss's baby Mera was very cute.
Yes. I did. I like the I say Mera story. I really like that feels like where the actual juice of this story outside of the KO stuff is happening. And that's an interesting story, getting into some familial backstory for her. So that's cool. And the art just across the board, I thought was really nice. I love the very clean lines. It's very, like, especially for something that is taking place under the sea, a famously blurry place.
Yeah, but it's also doing, like, a lot of jumping around time-wise. So, yeah, that got a little weird.
Null, number one from Marvel, written by Al Ewing and Tom Waltz, art by Juanan Ramirez, picking up off the cliffhanger from, I want to say, Venom 250. Null has been imprisoned by Hela, who wants to become the Queen in Black. Spoiler alert, there's an event coming called Queen in Black later this year, so I think she's going to do pretty well with this. But this is leading up to that, showing how Null gets out of his prison, the mission that he's heading on next. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, this is great. I thought this was a really fun setup first issue. Null is talking with Hela there and figuring stuff out. So, yeah, I thought this did a great job of, like, amping things up to get you excited for what's to come. And great art, great setup.
I love Al Ewing on this and Tom Waltz, like, bringing some mythology, like, fairy tale.
Justin, real quick,
logic.
How do you say null, just so people...
I say null.
Oh, okay.
When you say null, like Noel Gallagher. Right? That's what we're getting
I guess.
Here.
That's what I just found out today.
Yeah. That's okay. We all... The beauty of the English language is that you can say anything however you want.
You can butcher it?
Yeah.
And then people listen, got to be like, what the...
Yeah. It's okay. We're nailing it right now. It's no.
Just on the mythology bent, I thought after a pretty dense beginning couple of pages that put me off a little bit, it completely cleaned everything away and became much more sparse and interesting on, I want to say, like page 4 or 5 or something like that, which was very purposeful, I think, pacing thing that went on there.
Yeah.
But got everything you needed from the main thrust of the action, so I was very happy about that. I was also happy that I feel like they went a far way to define what Null actually is, because even having read the whole King in Black thing, I was like, what is his deal? He smiles a lot. I don't know. But they very specifically dialed down, and he's the god of the void, so what does that mean, and what are his powers? And I thought that part was great. That worked really well.
Especially a character whose origin sort of straddles the very different Venom and Thor mythologies that Null is sort of sprung out of. Like, I really did appreciate the clarification and full origin at top, even though it was a bit dense, to get to the story that was fun. Bold move to be the guard of a dude wearing his symbiote armor. I was like, risky. You don't want to wear the clothes of the dude who you're keeping prisoner and sort of torturing, because he's going to take those clothes back and probably be mad about it. Enjoy this. Looking forward to the event. For the Queen of Black seems fun.
That's a great advice, though, Justin. Don't torment the person you're imprisoning. You know what I mean?
No, I just said don't wear the same clothes, because that person's going
to
want
And just to clarify, there's like 4 more issues of this, so... Yeah, this is going to keep going, guys.
Well, but I mean, Hela even says, like, I want to be the Queen of Black. This is the story. Yes. She's very clear with, I'm going to be the Queen of Black. Yeah. There's no hiding what's happening here.
Geiger, number 20 from Ghost Machine and Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Gary Frank. In this issue, Geiger, our radioactive man, meets the Northerner, time-traveling guy who's usually trying to keep the Civil War on track. Now maybe he's going to prevent the Unknown War. And we find out a lot more about him after his appearance over in Redcoat. What'd you guys think? I thought this was very fun, personally.
Oh, interesting. I don't know. For me, like, I've been loving Geiger. But time travel stuff can get a little wonky for me. So I was a little nervous about this kind of happening in this, but I was very happy when I got to see the two-headed wolf dog. So,
how did you feel about him being like, get out of here, you dog? I don't need you.
Yeah, that was hard.
He's throwing rocks at us.
I was going to ask about Zigzag the zebra. Now that he's a large zebra that you can ride, how do you feel about that, Pete?
Zigzag's great. Fantastic.
Even
name.
When he's that large? When he's as large as, like, a regular horse?
Alex, little zebras grow up to big zebras.
Never. No, you got to clip them like bonsai.
What?
Clip their skin?
Yeah. That's what I did with my kids to keep them small.
They are tiny and mad. They're so mad.
Great. Moving on to Supergirl number 9 from DC Comics, written by Sophie Campbell, art by Joe Quinones. In this issue, Supergirl and her friends go to a party, get a little Krypton Girl wasted, if you know what I mean.
Oh, boy.
This is a book that a lot of folks in our Discord have been talking about and asking why we're not reviewing it, so I figured I'd throw it into
that's
the stack
nice of
here.
You listen to the people. That's nice.
I do. I'm not like you, Pete, who is constantly like, don't listen to the people. I do listen to the people.
Oh, wow.
Do you think this book is a blatant tie-in to the Supergirl movie because she has to party more?
I don't think this is
the party setup to maybe the Supergirl movie?
Probably not, but maybe. What did you guys think about this issue?
I really like this book. I think the story and art is just really works together well. I like Joe Quinones' work. So really great to see it here in the center of a superhero story. I do think on page like 2, one of the characters is wearing a serpent's jacket straight out of Riverdale. So I shouts to that. That helps inform sort of the vibe of what's happening in this story, I thought, throughout.
Yeah, shouts to Riverdale for sure. Yeah, the art is such a fresh breath of air that is really just so nice. Sometimes with DC books, you get used to a kind of this similar art all the time. So it was really refreshing to get this in this book.
There we go. Luna Snow World Tour number 1 from Marvel, written by Greg Pak, art by Ario Anandito and Takeshi Miyazawa. After the end of One World Under Doom, Luna Snow is on the outs with the world because she backed Doom. Oops. Is trying to go on a world tour. She runs into a new villain who has the ability to control crowds and make them fall in love with their terrible pop songs, leading to a conflict between Luna Snow and her allies and this new villain. I thought this also was a lot of fun. I know I just expressed what I felt about One World Under Doom, but if it led to this, this is a very fun issue. In particular, without feeling derivative, if you're a big fan of K-pop Demon Hunters, this feels right in the mode there. You can pick this right up there and run with it. It's similarly musically inflected. There's bad guys, there's good guys, bad managers, good managers. I had a fun time reading this book.
And Luna Snow, a character from Marvel Rivals, I believe, as well, right?
I don't think she was originally from Marvel Rivals, but she became popularized for sure by Marvel Rivals.
I think she's from Frozen. You know what I mean?
Nice. Nope. The way this lets a character be wrong, I thought was really good. Like, Greg Pak writes a story that just feels fresh. A character who is like, yeah, I backed Doom. Do you now? Now everyone hates me, but I learned a lesson. Like, it's a kind of storytelling that you don't see in comics. It's a gray area for a lot of the characters in this. And I thought it was like just a nice story about coping with the choices you make and moving forward despite them.
Yeah, I agree. Greg Pak is an amazing writer. This stuff isn't really my jam. It's more of a kind of like a Dazzler type story, which is more of a Zelbin kind of jam. But art was great.
Because you hate all music, right?
Well, music sometimes is tough in comics, you know. Sometimes it can kind of pull you out of a story.
And life, right?
Well, life.
Aren't you always telling those kids next door to turn down their rappity rap music, I believe is the phrase you said?
No, it's the opposite of what I'm saying.
Okay.
Like, I mean, I will say Pete is more likely to be like, hey, kids, turn up your rappity rap music.
That's right. That is fair. That's true. 100%. Beneath the Trees, Where Nobody Sees, Rite of Spring, number 5 from IDW by Patrick Horvath. In this issue, some big stuff goes down in an absolutely wild way as Samantha Strong, our serial killer bear, is taking her duck friend to the woods. And I'm almost hesitant to say anything about this issue because it is... IDW, in their solicit, were like, the most surprising ending of the year. And I was like, yeah, right, prove it to me. And then at the end of the issue, I was like, it was. And it just goes in some absolutely bonkers directions here. But I think it really also starts to bring together a lot of the themes and ideas that Patrick has been dealing with over the course of the series, which he's been sort of like slow playing or letting run under the surface in a different way in this series than he did in the previous one.
It's just electric storytelling, I feel like. for especially for a book that feels like it's going to be meticulous, slow boiling story about a serial killer trying to get away in these small moments. This issue is not afraid of the big moments. It reminds me of like the big episodes of like Breaking Bad, where mm-hmm. so much shit happens and you're like, how could they possibly move in any direction? You can't go back. I don't know how you go forward. And this story does that. So, I mean, we glow about this book. All three of us, I think, if I remember correctly. So, I think just to keep blowing the shine.
I love this.
Please read this book, but you have to read it from the beginning. Each issue pushes the story forward in a way that you must experience. Yeah.
This is not my cup of tea. I don't want to. Obviously, you guys love this, and I'm happy for you to find something that you enjoy. But it's like they, were like, hey, remember the Childhood Berenstain Bears story that you love so much? I'm like, yeah, I sure do. We're going to ruin your childhood.
This ruins the Berenstain Bears, is your complaint?
I can't even look at the Berenstain Bears.
Have you read the Berenstain Bears?
How often are you rereading?
They're fucked up, those stories.
Agreed.
Not that I recall.
Do you remember? Did you ever read the Berenstain Bears and the New Baby? I'll throw that one out at you, Pete. Do you know what happens to that?
Don't remember that one.
Sure.
I thought they lived in a tree.
They live in a tree. Father takes brother, who is very upset about a new baby coming, is like, well, now why don't you come out into the woods? We'll get a tree.
This is fun
we'll
that make, this make stack has turned into story time.
And then they take the crib, and when they come back, Mother Bear has had a baby on her own in the tree while they've been gone. That's pretty messed up.
That's fucked up. But did you read the Berenstain Bears hide a corpse? They
is that
also
they
hide
up
it in a tree.
People and put them in paint cans and then bury them in
the
woods?
Yeah, there was the Berenstain Bears cut up a duck and put it in paint cans, which, you know, it's funny we haven't brought that up in relation to this book yet.
Got to be a big inspiration. But, Pete, I want to investigate a little harder here because, like, is it the violence that gets you or is it the fact that it's told in from a art perspective that it is like a children's book?
Yeah.
Is it the juxtaposition of those things?
It's a lot of it. It's also the celebration of the violence that's heartbreaking.
I don't think it's a celebration of violence. You love books that celebrate violence. So where are you in this? That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
If the Punisher was cuter, how would you feel about that?
Oh, man, I don't think I'd like it at all.
Interesting.
You don't think the Punisher's cute, Pete? I think he's pretty cute.
All right,
strong
imagine
jaw.
This. You're at a bar, right? You look across the bar, Punisher's right there.
Oh,
what are you doing?
Oh,
he's blowing kisses at you, Pete, in his little shirt.
Oh, man.
He's wearing his little shirt.
The art is fantastic.
Can I buy that LePage a drink down there?
Well, anyway, let's move on and talk about Minor Arcana number 13 from Boom Studios by Jeff Lemire. In this issue, our main character is doing some more tarot stuff, and ooh, that's what happens.
Yeah, it's one of those classic creepy tarot readings, you know, you get in comics and movies. It's a fun trope that I think works really well here. I just feel I love how Jeff Lemire this story is. I know it's a weird thing to say, but just like being in a Jeff Lemire book and the world and the vibe, it's this fun kind of creepy, not sure what's going on. You can kind of feel the sweat sometimes on the panels. It's just a cool, interesting world that he creates. And what's nice is when you're familiar with your work, his work, it's just kind of a fun world to be in. You know, you feel well taken care of, and it's cool.
This book, this issue was the most reminiscent of Sweet Tooth. If you're a fan of that book, I think this series feels a bit different than that. But this issue specifically felt like there were some like schemes going on. There were some surprising dips into the supernatural here. Like, so it really brought me back to reading some of those issues of Sweet Tooth, especially later in the series. I do like this book. It does feel like it is settling into a slower pace. But I actually think a lot happens here. It feels that way, but I think there are a lot of things happening. I really like the back half of this issue in particular.
Yeah, I think you're getting to the heart of how I'm feeling about it. I keep going back and forth on it. I like it every issue, but sometimes I have a little bit of a hard time getting a handle on what the arc of an individual issue is versus over the course of many issues, and it keeps feeling like, okay, we're ramping up to something, and now we've hit a plateau for several issues, and now we're ramping up to something, and maybe that's just the rhythm of the book, but I don't know. It's sometimes not quite enough of a TP, if you understand my term, on an individual basis for me to get into.
Alex, that's the rhythm is going to get you.
Oh, God, I got to watch out for that. Side Dimensional Rivals, number one from Marvel by Peach Momoko, Stan Sakai, and Ivan Coelho. Speaking of Marvel Rivals, yet another Marvel Rivals-inspired book. Boy, that game seems to be doing well, I guess. Here we are getting a Peach Momoko riff on Psylocke, who gets recruited by a Peach Momoko riff on Galacta. We got Beast in here, and the whole idea is she gets sent looking for an Infinity Stone through different dimensions, and each time she ends up in a different dimension, it is a new artist who is taking on the character. In this case, Stan Sky and Ivan Coelho. In future issues, it will be other artists. I should have written them down. I know Asad Rabish is going to be on it, and some other folks as well. Pete, you seem to be a big fan of this. I'm guessing it might be because you like Peach Momoko and Stan Sakai and hate Ivan Coelho, but you take it away from here.
How dare you? Yeah, I love all the artists on this book. This is such a great vibe. The look of this is just so fantastic. Psylocke, one of my favorite characters. So such a fun use of this. And it's also, I love the juxtaposition of kind of a Galactica.
It's pronounced Justin Position.
Oh, my bad. The Justin Position of Galactica being like, we need these stones. And Psylocke being like, oh, like you need a pebble. And I think that says so much. So just really impressive, fun story, cool adventure, amazing visuals. And also, we got not only do you get Peach Momoko, but then you get this kind of fun.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it's really nice that Stan Sakai is in this. I don't know if anyone else noticed his artwork in the back half of this.
Yeah,
that was really cool. What were you saying, Pete?
No, so I was trying to build towards this, Ronin, you know, Usagi Yojimbo look to it, where all of a sudden
I'm always trying to get us to read and review Usagi Yojimbo, who is my absolute favorite rabbit Ronin, and it's just a bummer that some other folks on the podcast, specifically members of the podcast, who virulently and disgustingly hate Ivan Coelho for no particular reason that I can gather.
Justin, how dare
you? Don't want to read it, Pete.
It's funny. He's my sixth favorite rabbit Ronin.
Oh, weird. You got five.
We should do our power rankings of the rabbit Ronin.
Yeah.
We should do it.
Oh, yeah. Man, that'd be fun to hear five others. Would be impressive. Yeah.
I have 15. He's just in the middle.
By the way, to be clear, Ivan Coelho is great as well. And I also really enjoyed this. I thought the art was great. I thought the story was fun. It is a fun riff. It is kind of crazy to me how on the Marvel Rivals beat Marvel Comics is right now. And I get it because it's a huge game. But it seems like it's just like growing every week to become half of the books that we're reading.
Well, but it's crazy how much we're like, Marvel, make your comics tie into the movies. And they're like, we don't do that. But they're tying so much into Rivals, which is like, that must be working. So I think it's cool. And honestly, like, I like this story more than I like some of the Ultimate X-Men stuff, because it feels more contained and more like direct from a storytelling perspective. So not to pit these books against each other, but I really like this. I definitely want to pick up the next one. I also appreciate the format of the bit of anthology that's in here, despite the fact that the stories do connect. I do have the other artists coming. Asad Ribish, Natasha Bustos, Mike Del Mundo, Jim Mahfood, Umberto Ramos.
Nice. Awesome.
Great lineup. Should be fun.
Yeah.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number 14 from IDW, written by Gene Luen Yang, art by Freddie E. Williams. The second last issue, it was revealed that the new villain, Ujigami, is actually Splinter, who is back alive.
Oh. What? Splinter's alive?
Not only that, Pete, Splinter is a villain, and the Turtles are slowly figuring that out this issue as they battle him, as well as a giant bear, I believe, who has been sent to trial.
Sure, the old
trial. How do you feel about that? You don't like the giant bear who kills people in Beneath the Trees. Do you like the giant bear who kills people in this issue?
Sure do, buddy. Completely different bears, completely different setup here. One of them's not trying to murder my childhood.
Do you want me to make you a shirt that says different bears, same day?
No, I don't. I would like you to make something about murdering my childhood, though. Because
what if I made a shirt that said, just to clarify, no?
Just to clarify, you're wrong, is what.
No, that's what it was. Just to clarify, you're wrong.
Yeah. But first off, let's back up the truck. Cool cover. This is just fun times, man. You know, we get these kind of super ninja.
Pause there.
Super ninja great stuff here. Leo figuring something out. Then boom, Splinter is back. And you're so excited, but then you're like, oh no, this is going to be more heartbreaking than we thought. So I'm nervously excited for what's to come.
Do you feel like the Turtles can really connect with this villain, Splinter?
Well, I mean, they can connect with Splinter, but this villain is going to be a tough pig to roast, if you know what I'm saying.
I don't know that phrase. But this is, I mean, there's a lot going on in this title now, and the Rocksteady Bebop of it all is pretty wild.
Oh, that was hysterical. They had some great lines in there. Some hilarious lines. I laughed out loud a couple times. How the shell you doing?
A lot of pun. It's the Toidles.
Yeah.
A lot of celebrating their own jokes.
I mean,
which
just
is
to jump off of what you're saying, Justin, I like this team. This issue felt very crowded to me, like both from the art perspective and the writing perspective. Like you said, there's a lot going on, but it's also a lot packed into every page. And I don't know, I miss the sparseness of the previous run. I think they weren't this packed necessarily in the last issue because I thought that moved very well, but I wasn't quite sure about this one. Sorry, Pete. Babs, the Black Road.
Really
there was a pregnant pause there. Babs, the Black Road South, number one from Ahoy Comics, written by Garth Ennis, art by Jason Burrows. This is a sequel series to Babs, which was a parody fantasy series about a Red Sonja type who encounters some toxic masculinity, a little white nationalism. It was very of the moment, but through the lens of these fantasy tropes. And I thought very funny, but also very profane and gross in the classic Garth Ennis manner. Mm-hmm. Here, we've kind of done away with a lot of the satire, like the more pointed satire elements, and instead just have a mashup of fantasy world and modern world as, I was about to say, Sonja Babs and her friend Izzy end up coming into some money, have a wild, debaucherous night out, including a full-on musical number making fun of Red Sonja. And then when they wake up in the morning, they have to track down their buddy that they accidentally gave away. So,
classic.
I don't know. I thought this was still funny, and I had a fun time reading this because it's ridiculous and over the top. But I was missing a little bit of that of-the-moment cultural commentary of the first series.
That's funny. I didn't miss that. I liked that this story focused more on them just doing stuff and them having a quest. I felt like a really clean entrance to the story. The scene of them just, like, fucking gremlins or some kind of...
I believe it was Nobgoblins.
Nobgoblins. Right. Now that tracks.
Yeah.
They take home a couple of nobbies, and they are just getting it done. And they're the way the story, the way the adventure is cast on. They put all their money, basically invested it in a quest, and now they have to go make sure the quest pays off. I do think we're going to get some cultural commentary. We just haven't quite got it yet. It feels very like gambling culture, poly market could be the take. It just hasn't been fully, this trap hasn't been sprung yet, I think.
Fucking nobbers. Yeah, I think this is a blast. And
nobbers, dude.
Yeah, fucking nobbers guy. But I think that this is I found the sword, the talking sword, as it's like cutting off people's heads, being like had a little things to say each time, like oh sorry, and all that was great. A total blast. And yeah, just kind of the classic fun of like we got drunk and wake up the next day, where'd all the money go, kind of fun. So yeah, I thought the art and storytelling was a blast. And I enjoyed this.
The Ultimates, number 20 from Marvel, written by Dennis Camp, art by Phil Noto. In this issue, picking up off the cliffhanger of the last issue, we meet the new Vision of the Ultimate Universe, find out his origin. He is, in fact, a character we know and set up as a opposite of Nick Fury here as they've battled throughout the ages, leading to a big moment and a big confrontation at the end of the issue. Justin, I know you were a big fan of this one, so why is that?
It's just big storytelling. We get the whole, like you said, this whole great origin of the Vision, the triple agent that... Janet Van Dyne was, I thought was a nice reveal last issue. We don't really see much of her, which I was surprised about. But I liked all of the, like, linking up the Ultimate Network. It felt like them pushing back the Detroit kaiju that is created in here. Mm-hmm. I thought was awesome. Like, it was just a real rallying point for this big fight that's been happening in the Ultimate Universe. So, here for it.
So you're still camping, is what you're saying. Still loving the camp.
I remain at camp. Everyone else wants to leave and go on a hike and go canoeing. And I'm saying, stay at camp. Camp is fun.
Yeah, I would get on a canoe and get away from Vision because that dude is creepy as fuck. And I don't trust it, especially if he's killed Nick Fury 14 times. You know what I mean? That seems
like a good thing.
Yeah, Nick Fury is a bad guy in this universe.
Well... yeah, but, I'm not used to that, you know, so.
Oh, okay. This is great. The art is great. Everything that you mentioned, Justin, is great. And just to expand on that, like, rallying cry thing, I think that's something that Dennis Camp is doing so well, particularly in the Ultimates, from Iron Lad's announcement onward. It just feels, it gets your blood pumping when you read
exactly.
It.
Exactly, and
it's not to keep hitting on the same point, but like it's not directly analogous to things that are happening outside our window right now. But when there is a lot of action happening in the outside world, there are a lot of marches, there are a lot of protests. It feels like this taps into that same sort of energy of rise up against a fascist government that I know reading a comic is not a substitute for that necessarily, but that does feel like the thing that they are riffing on here, and it does make it feel very present.
Any place you can get that feeling in this day and age is nice.
Yeah. Alice Forever After, number one for Boom Studios, written by Dan Panosian, art by Dan Panosian and Giorgio Spoleto. This is the third series riffing on Alice in Wonderland that Dan Panosian has done, paralleling action inside Wonderland with things happening in London to the real Alice. We, if I remember correctly, loved the first series, were okay with the second series, didn't exactly love but respected The Lost Boy, which was sort of like not part of this, but yeah, the Peter Pan riff. And now here we are at the fourth sort of riff series, and the big change here is that Wonderland Tron Ares style is coming to the real world. That's gonna change potentially everything. So what do you guys think? I know we're just one issue in, but as something we've been following for a while, how do you think this held up to the standard of the other things that I mentioned?
I like this. I mean, there's just such a darkness to the main story, and the actual Alice stuff feels like it's waiting to do something, and it's been sort of like she's always in treatment, and it's always about her sort of getting in and out in the way these villains are taking advantage of her. So, like, that feels like it's a little bit in stasis, but I love the Wonderland stuff, and I especially love the sequence of the tea being delivered by Alice's daughter to Alice. I thought that was just... great scene, beautifully drawn, well-paced, such tension and dread. I thought that was just excellent.
Yeah, the art's a real hero here. It's really impressive, that creepy scary, kind of tripped out vibe that it's putting out there. It was cool to see the caterpillar in the real world and all that kind of stuff going on. Yeah, this is just such a weird and interesting story. And I think the cover art does a great job of setting the tone for what's inside and what to come. So, yeah, I'm not sure about everything yet, but I'm enjoying this ish.
Alex, I feel like you're the biggest fan of this series on the podcast. How did you like this issue?
I was all right with it. I don't think it has gotten more pressing or thematically tied together than the first series. Like, that just absolutely nailed it in my mind. That first series paralleled what was going on with Alice with Wonderland really well. It was crushing. It was devastating in terms of the reveals. I wasn't quite sure, and I'm still not quite sure why we were continuing it in the second series. My concern, even though I like this first issue and everything that you guys said, I totally agree with, art's great, story is interesting, there are really good scenes in it, is it won't justify its existence beyond the conclusion point that they already hit in that first series. That's my concern here. But I'm willing to follow it anyway because I generally am intrigued by what Dan Pedosian is doing, even if I don't love all of it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. There you go. Now, Justin, let me ask you, when you saw the caterpillar, did you think about Alex walking around the streets in New York? Or was that just me?
Because he's always like smoking a sick hookah.
Yeah. And Alex just kind of walk around being all like, oh, I'm a caterpillar, you know?
Yeah. He does walk around his Brooklyn neighborhood like a real big deal. Walking into people's buildings. Like, hey.
Yeah, I'm a caterpillar.
I'm a guy. Alex.
Pillar of the community.
Wow, wow, wow. Yep. Were you going to say something real, Justin? Or
I do think maybe this is building towards something. I feel like it must be. Let me say that. I think it must be building towards something big. And I think we're going to get that at the end of this series.
Last but not least, The Uncanny X-Men number 22 from Marvel, written by Gail Simone, art by David Marquez. In this issue, Mutina is back just in time for Nightcrawler's birthday.
And
oh,
man.
Oh, boy. It's going to be a bad birthday for our favorite fuzzy elf. What'd you guys think about this one? We're in the shadows of tomorrow. We are back in the regular continuity for The Uncanny X-Men.
Tomorrow.
I like that the Mutina character, I think, is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the first story. This feels very much like a middle story. I don't know what it's getting at. I thought the fight with Wolverine was good, and especially the Nightcrawler fight sort of taking a completely different tact to taking on this villain.
What'd you think about the lady got bamfed 4 times? Do you think that was
sick?
Yeah.
I believe it was 5 times, right?
I thought it was 4. I had 4 down in my notes.
No, I don't know.
Oh,
I think 4, but I think that's cool. That's how Nightcrawler does it.
I can't quite hook into Mutina as a character yet. I feel like there's something I'm missing about her. Maybe there's some information that's being held back or something like that. I do like this issue. This had the pleasant feel of classic Claremont issues where it was all focused around an event and then some villain would come in and ruin it, which gives it a really nice focus here. Nightcrawler is great throughout. I love him. Wolverine being like, you'll never take down Mutina. And he'll be like, he's like, no worries. I can carry 3 swords, one with my tail.
Yeah. Very fun. His talk? Just,
I don't know. Gail Simone clearly has a really good handle on all of these characters, but particularly Nightcrawler in this issue, which is nice to see. And David Marquez's visuals throughout are great as well.
I think the comment here is something about like modern, like internet culture, fame chasing. I think that's what Mutina is representing, and where we don't know, because she's sort of saying like, I just want to be an X-Man or I'm going to kill you, where there's there's a certain lack of morality and a sort of cravenness of just like, I have to do this one thing. I don't care what I have to do to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting idea, but that's what you're feeling, Alex, is we just feel like it's in the middle of it. We need a definitional moment for her. And maybe we're going to get that, because I think this is a character that Gail Simone seems very interested in that we will probably see again.
And that is it for the stack.
Wait, one last thing I want to say. Something I missed in the Transformers book. There's a panel here where someone says, someone find Matt Tracker. Pete, is this Tracker? Is this the crossover you've been waiting for?
That would be sick, man.
His name Matt Tracker?
No, his name isn't Matt Tracker.
What is it? It's Dan Tracker?
John Tracker?
I don't know. They just call him Tracker. I don't.
Wait, he doesn't have
really?
A name?
Yeah. I don't know what his
name is. That's crazy.
I really thought
we were joking here. I thought it had to surely be like Ted Racker or something like that.
Yeah. Ted Racker is Tracker? Is that what you're
saying? T. Racker.
Yeah. His name is Coulter Shaw.
Coulter Shaw? That's right. Somehow worse. That's much worse.
What are you talking about? That's a sweet, sweet name.
Coulter?
Yeah, Coulter Shaw.
Coulter's not a real name.
That's an AI-generated idea.
What are you talking about?
That's somebody who was at the craft service table, and they're like, listen, we really need to come up with a name of the Tracker.
Shit was going down, and they're like, don't worry, Coulter Shaw is on it. You'd be like, oh, I feel better.
Yeah. They were trying to say Colton, but then they messed it up and said Coulter instead, and they just had to move forward.
That character is a typo.
How dare you?
Well, that's it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do at patreon.com/comicbookclub, where you can get access to our Week in Geek podcast, where this is not a joke. We talk about Tracker all the time.
Sure do.
Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show, comicbookclublive.com, for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Plus, get free premium delivery on any bed with base. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store today.